Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Fran Lewis and this is going to be really exciting. The sun is shining outside, so that's a good sign that it's not snowing yet. And we have the author of Concrete Smile here, and I'm going to talk to Bernard in just a minute because this book is really exciting. For those of you out there that ever thought about joining a gang, you're going to think twice after you read this book, I can tell you that. And for those of you that can't think it's cool, you're going to think twice before you get it. Think that too. Okay, but before I start, I have to thank the people at Ardsley Cucina for treating me like I'm a rock star yesterday. The pizza was better than anywhere else. Absolutely fantastic. And the veggie wrap was great. And the fact that you treated me as if I was very special made it even more I want to come back. And your review about your restaurant is on your Facebook wall and Yelp. And if I could give it 10 stars, I would have. And I want to thank you so much. And if you want to go there, they are at 935 Sumner River Road in Ardsley, New York. And just tell them Fran from Blog Talk Radio sent you. And Bernard Mistress is here, and Bernard's book is called The Concrete Smile. Someone wants a war. You know, gangs like wars. Someone has taken a match to the criminal underbelly of Newport City and turned its factions against each other. The city's only hope lies in the hands of an unlikely trio. Hi, Brian. Hi, Bernard. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. I'm good. Calling from sunny Hawaii right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the mid-70s as we are year-round.
It sounds so beautiful. They actually, my sister went there 100 years ago on a honeymoon, and she didn't want to come back. She went
yeah,
to Honolulu.
I think that that's a pretty common story.
It sounds too beautiful. So could you give us just a slight summary for the listeners and those people that are haunting me in the chat room?
Yeah. So I think this is kind of the hardest part of writing, is kind of summing up, you know, what you spend all this time working on and, you know, all these long chapters. But it's basically a crime thriller, but I tried to give it more of a modern and a little bit of a younger attitude and everything. So that's, I think, shows through in the characters who are a little more, again, you know, youthful and have a little more attitude than maybe some of the film noir characters that inspired my writing. So the basic plot is that there's about to be a gang war in this fictional city that I made up, Newport City. And one of the people who works with the various criminal organizations there is what I call an information broker. He sells people information, whatever it is. He makes his business knowing things and selling information to people, is hired to find out who's trying to start this war, because one of the gang leaders doesn't believe that it's all the gangs in the city are just decided to attack each other at once. So he, you know, gets some help along the way from his brother who just came back from prison, and his and this woman who's a freelance journalist who gets involved after her boyfriend is killed in kind of in the crossfire. And then, of course, you know, the mystery takes, and don't want to give away too much about that because I think it's pretty clever, but I would say it's a pretty decent summary of it.
No, that's exactly perfect. So why gang violence? And does Hawaii have a lot of gang problems? Because they're not in the news enough. They're not in the news except for when a volcano erupts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting, actually. Hawaii is, well, Honolulu is considered the safest big city in America. And we really don't have the gangs that I think that you see in the movies and that you see in the news and stuff like that. We have, you know, we have everybody, every place is going to have its share of organized crime, but we're very fortunate to not have the kind of violence and the, you know, the overwhelming spread of it that you have in places like Los Angeles and New York, where I'm actually from New York City. So we're very fortunate not to have that here, you know, knock on wood.
Well,
of course.
I grew up in the South Bronx.
Mm-hmm. So you know exactly what I mean.
Do I? Yeah, I do. It was tough growing up there, but I'm a little person, 5 feet tall, and never let anybody intimidate me till this day. I mean,
right.
I was there before we moved to another area in the Bronx, it was getting dangerous, kind of, and I was walking on the street, and this young guy stopped me. to ask him a question, and I just spoke to him in a foreign language that he never heard, and he ran away.
Mm-hmm.
And I scared the heck out of him, and I felt so brave. Miss 5 feet tall of me, but he can't be afraid on the street. Yeah, and I taught at a tough school in the Bronx, too. So you know. So tell us about Newport City and how you created this particular city. As a matter of fact, I looked it up, and there's a Newport City somewhere. I think in Minnesota or something.
Well, I didn't think there was a Newport City, but there are a few Newports out there. I didn't find a Newport City. But actually, many years ago, one of the, as I mentioned in my other interviews, I wrote basically three books that came together to form Concrete Smile. And in one of them, several years ago, I wrote about New York. I was trying to write about, you know, where I grew up in Brooklyn. And one of the big harsh criticisms of that book was, you know, New York is nothing, because I haven't been there in 20 years. And the harsh criticism was, you know, this is really not what New York is today. So anybody who's you know, from there is going to look at this and say it's, you know, inauthentic. So a friend of mine actually gave me a piece of advice and said, well, why don't you just make up your own city, because then you can do whatever you want with it. And so that was something I had been working on for a while. And when I set out to write Concrete Smile, it was just, you know, hanging out there is this idea of this, you know, big city that I can do, that is my personal playground, and I can just, you know, do whatever I want and put whatever I want in there. So that was the, so I guess it's was inspired by New York City, but I used a fictional setting so that I can just have, you know, complete creative license over it and everything.
Yeah, well, I find that what happens if you use a real city and you happen to give some points of interest or some roads or some information about it, and you're wrong, then the viewers and the readers get it. I live there. How do you not know? So you're better off with something fake.
Exactly, so, exactly. And that was what I ran into with that other book, and so that's why I did the fictional one.
Well, tell us about Kevin and becoming an information broker and how he decided to get called in on this particular case that he gets called in on.
Well, I think Kevin's story is, without giving away too much, one of his kind of quirks, I think, is that he's very intelligent, and he kind of enjoys feeling like he's more intelligent than other people, and that he knows things that not everybody else knows. And so it kind of is a natural connection to go from that to, oh, I can find out all these things and you know, make a living selling them to people. As far as why he would get into working with criminals, it's kind of goes back to his backstory. I guess he kind of grew up in this, you know, rough fictional city with, you know, surrounded by gangs and crime, and it's kind of the only thing he knows. He grew up in that world, so it would only make sense that he would work there, you know, work within that community, if you want to call it that. That would be how he would start, would be, you know, make a deal here, make a deal there. You know, you happen to hear an interesting tidbit on the street, pass it on to somebody who's willing to pay for it. Eventually it becomes a bigger business.
That's a scary business that he got into. I don't know. He's taking a big chance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure. He gets drawn into this case because the leader of one of the major city gangs knows him, or knows him by reputation, and figures if anybody is going to be able to dig up the truth and find out who or what is behind the you know, the attacks going on the criminal interests, that it would be him. So he hires
him. And he's good. I liked him. Mm-hmm. I liked Chance too. And if you can bring back everybody, and bring him back too. So why does he hook his brother into prison, and he gets out of prison, and how come he hooks him into this right away?
Well, it's mostly, I think he kind of says it in the, he tells him straight up, like, hey, you know, I know, you know, you need a job now that you're out. I'd rather have one where I can keep an eye on you, which I think is pretty, how do I put it? I feel like it's kind of a role reversal because I hint throughout the book that Chance has kind of been responsible for looking out for Kevin for, you know, quite a while, and then now it's Kevin's turn to kind of say, no, I need to, you know, I need you where I can look out for you and, you know, watch your back.
Well, so, he's good. I like Chance. He's a great character, let me tell you.
Yeah, you know, I noticed that there's, because there are the three main characters in the book, that kind of everybody has a favorite. There's one that everybody else kind of identifies with, and you know, a lot of people who've read it are like, oh, I like Katie or I like Chance, and you know, did you really need the other character? And that was kind of the point, was, yeah, you liked him, but somebody else liked somebody else. So it's good because, you know, you can kind of pick a favorite and have somebody to root for.
Well, you can't have the story without the three of them. I mean,
true.
That would be
also
ridiculous.
True.
You can't have, you know, Kevin is impetuous and she's tough, which I really liked. I mean, I like the fact that she didn't like make her mamby-pamby and afraid of her own shadow, and that she could take out some guys herself. That's what I thought was so cool.
Yeah.
That's what made it more credible, yeah.
For sure.
So Katie's boyfriend was killed, and he wasn't exactly the best character in the world. So she learns a bit. He learns a He's like an unsavory character, and yet she's a news reporter. It's weird. That was an interesting mix. How come you did that?
I think what I was going for there is kind of the idea that you know, there's a lot of people who are more one foot in, one foot out, or should say one foot in each world in this city. You know, they may have some ties to the criminal side of things, but then they're also, you know, living on the honest side and trying to make an honest living as well. So he is, he's not a perfect character, but I wouldn't call him a bad guy outright. And I think that's what I really wanted to get across in that. So, but you're right. He is, got a checkered past, shall we say, but he's also, you know, has some redeeming qualities too. And that's, I think in a lot, in big cities, there's, quite a few people who are like that. I think the people who are pure evil would be more rare than those who are kind of a little bit of both.
Well, you let us get in on it because I thought it was really clever that you did the backstory and you gave us the flashback to both of them and how they met and why she found him wonderful. So you sort of get to know him a little bit better so that you understand why she's so upset that he was killed. So how did you create that special dialogue in between the chapters to let everybody get to know Kyle better and why she decided to move out of her home and take on this case?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there were three books that I wrote or partially wrote that I combined for this book. And one of them was all about her, Katie. She was the, you know, the sole protagonist, and a lot of that backstory was part of that novel. So when I went to salvage, you know, what I could from it, and I was looking at what parts of the story were important and what parts of the story were, you know, I could translate over, that was one of the things that really stood out. Because I didn't want to just make it such a straight ahead, like, okay, you know, here's the next clue, here's the next step, boom, boom, boom. You know, put some life in the characters and put some life in the backstories and make you really understand that these are, make you feel like they're real people. So that was definitely, it was kind of an easy choice to say, oh yeah, I'm going to try to salvage this part of the backstory. You know, what inspired that book, I had a death in the family a few years ago. And just as my way to process that, you know, handle the grief, I wrote this book. And you know, I decided to turn it into a mystery novel, and that's where it started. And I learned that I was not very good at writing mysteries at the time, and it was not a very good book. But what came out of it was the really personal scenes with those characters, and that's what I said, of all the things in that book, this is what I really want to save. I want to save the characters and their personal stories, and so that's where I pulled those from.
Well, I can identify with why you wrote the book. Because I lost my sister, and then I said I was going to decide. I wrote some children's books about our antics in the South Bronx, the two of us. So I wrote those before, and she actually got to read most of them and edit them and tell me I knew no first thing about spelling and writing, which is fine because I did that on purpose and tortured her.
Right.
I made her edit my books and stuff like that. But I created my network on Blog Talk Radio, MJ Network, after my sister, and the magazine that I created was after her too. So it makes sense, and it's sort of like it's hard to deal with it when you don't think anything's going to happen. And it was out of the blue. She wasn't even sick. So Katie is strong, and at times she seems vulnerable. How did you create those two opposite mixes? Because this character is really good, let me tell you, people. It's girl power. Let me tell you, it's really good.
I think personally for me, you know, if I had to pick one, she would be my favorite character. I really liked her a lot, which, you know, that helped inspire me to want to save her from, you know, the unpublished hell. But, you know, I feel like I didn't have to work that much to write her. I feel like she just grew naturally, and I feel like it was a natural divide between, you know, the vulnerability and the toughness, and that's a real thing, that the, you know, there's a lot of tough people out there that, you know, people don't think anything fazes them, but that's just not the case. And, you know, that the emotional parts of it I felt were pretty easy to write. I was, you know, kind of channeling my grief into that. And then the other parts where she's holding it together and putting on the brave face and going out and doing what she needs to until she has the time to stop and, you know, maybe break down a little bit and you know, vent all of that. That was probably the easiest parts of the book to write, honestly.
Really? It was interesting, though, because you got to know her as a person. The other person that I liked, I don't want to tell you what happens to him, is King Jamal. And why? I like this guy. And at first I said I wasn't sure, and then I realized he was tough, and he sort of got Kevin to take this case and try to stop the gangs. And he kept saying, when explaining the gangs, there's Red Nation, and then there's the Russians, and then there's the Chinese, and all of them. There were so many gangs, and he wanted to stop the war. Why didn't they want to stop the war? They wanted to keep going. They didn't care.
You know, I think in that world there's a lot of, power is perception. And if you allow yourself to be perceived as weak or vulnerable, you become a target, you become prey. And that is, I feel like that's kind of what makes them so vulnerable to this conspiracy in the book, that it's very easy to provoke them against each other. If there's even the hint that, you know, this group, encroached on our territory or insulted us or, you know, killed our people, we're going to hit back twice as hard. And King Jamal is, I agree. I actually think he's a pretty good character.
Like,
and he's probably, of all the characters in the book, he was around the longest, because I came up with him, I don't want to date myself, but let's just say I came up with him when I was 18, basically a lifetime ago. And
I won't even.
He's tough, but he's also very smart. And what he says, he tells Kevin when he's hiring him that the reason that he's doing it is not necessarily because he's some great, you know, philanthropist or anything like that, although I think there's more motivation than he really lets on. But what he tells him simply is, look, a war is bad for business. You know, nobody's going to make any money if we're out there killing each other in the streets and the cops get involved and everything else. So his you know, he has some selfish interest there that he just wants to keep. He wants to basically maintain the status quo so he can keep making money. But, you know, I think that I drop a few hints that maybe he, maybe he has some more positive motivations too, that he doesn't want to see the city get torn apart necessarily and want to see the results of what would come out of that.
Well, don't a lot of gangs, because I've read so many books on gangs, as you'll find out when I do the show on gangs, don't they sometimes, they fight for money, don't they sometimes fight to take over the turf of another gang?
Yeah, exactly. And in that regard, it's not all that different from, anything else in human history where, there's needs to be a balance to the power there. And anything that tips the balance one way or another can, you know, lead to violence. And so that's definitely true. You know, in the big cities, they have the territory is usually what's called corners. And, you know, the best corners, you want to be able to take those corners, but then you need to be able to hold them too. And when somebody decides they want that corner, that's where a lot of,
mm-hmm.
you know, a decent portion of violence comes from, because then it's going to be a fight over that piece of turf, basically.
That's so scary. That's just very
mm-hmm.
scary.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you never know. I mean, there were so many gangs in this book that,
mm-hmm.
Well, there was the Red Nation, and they didn't want
mm-hmm.
the war. And then there's the Russians. So let's
mm-hmm.
just go to the heist at the beginning of the book. There was a scene that was really scary with Bones and the first murder in the warehouse. Was that based
mm-hmm.
on a real incident? Or who came after Bones and his crew, and why didn't they want him to follow them? That was really, I was surprised you did it like that. That was great, because if they would have
mm-hmm.
all not, whatever, they probably would have said, oh,
mm-hmm.
so what, they got lucky, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you come up with that at the beginning of the book?
It was based on a combination of things. There's obviously some real world influence there, for sure. But when I originally came up with that scene, the first scene, and then the scene where King Jamal makes his first appearance, were the two that I kind of, you know, when I was 18. And the first inkling of it was just to kind of see somebody employ these, you know, military ambush tactics on this street gang who are, you know, they're very good. They're professional. They're, you know, they're violent. They're experienced. But to see them, you know, to see some tactics that they're not used to employed on them, I thought would be an interesting kind of concept, which, you know, I found it created a lot of tension, too. And it was a surprise that, you know, and of course, we're talking about it and giving it away, but it's, you know, first chapter, so I'm okay with that. But, you know, I thought it was a very surprising kind of twist to this chapter that I set up that I don't think people were really expecting, readers were expecting, based on the way I started it.
Definitely not. I don't think they're going to expect the ending of that chapter. They're going to be surprised. Like, what? So we've got King Jamal, who I like.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the Red Nation, the Russians, the Chinese Triad, all wanting a piece of the other. And
don't
some
forget
of them
didn't
want a war.
Dog.
Oh, yeah, and I can't pronounce that one. And then we've got the Smart Jacks. And why are they so powerful? They are scary. They are.
You know, I think that I don't want to talk about them too much because I feel
okay.
like they're kind of a plot twist that I think people are going to be really, really surprised by when they hit it. So they're there. They're a pretty interesting bunch. But I really would like I wouldn't want to ruin it for any of the readers out there for when they get to that part and suddenly you're, you know, face to face with these guys, so to speak.
Just make sure you keep the lights on when you watch it and you have people around because they're dangerous. And
mm-hmm.
you don't want to mess with these gangs. So who is
mm-hmm.
Michael Beecher? And tell him about AMC and why is he so powerful, too? I don't like him.
You know, again, I feel like that's sort of a plot twist, but, you know, to give some no spoilers answer to that. I think the easiest way to say it is a lot of people brought this up, actually, while I was writing it, and they said that, you know, everybody talks about, you know, the gang violence and the drugs and all that stuff like that, but nobody really talks about who they say, you know, who are the real criminals. And there are a lot of people in a lot of powerful positions and running a lot of the companies that really do run pretty much everything else that are no less ruthless than, you know, anybody else in basically in the book, you could say. And so I thought it was really important to include somebody like that, the executive, the CEO kind of person, you know, in power to kind of, as a contrast to these gang leaders that are in control of so much of the city, and yet how in charge are they really? And that was kind of the question that I wanted to make people think about.
That you did. Let me tell you, because it made sense. That's what I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense. It seriously made sense. So let's
not
talk about them anymore, or who he was connected to or whatever. And let's talk about my friend Kevin. And he goes out on a limb to go after the gangs, but he's not really equipped. What kind of training does he have that he won't get killed? Because he can't kill off the main character, not yet anyway.
Well, you know, he's I think everything that he's got comes from his streetwise. You know, he's maybe not, you know, he's not a martial arts black belt or anything. He's not a, you know, Navy SEAL, but he knows a lot of things, and he picks things up very quickly. He's very perceptive, very, you know, receptive to what's going on around him, and so he picks up things very quickly. And, you know, there's the one scene, there's a fight scene, and we, you know, I kind of imply that Chance taught him how to box, essentially. And it was probably very quick for him to pick that kind of thing up. But I think the biggest thing he's got going for him is, like I said, is that streetwise and that awareness of everything around him. He's not going to get caught by surprise. You know, nobody's going to catch him when he's not looking. So he's got a lot of that going for him. So it's going to be very hard. You're going to have to come at him head on. And on top of that, he has all these relationships with all these various, you know, criminal underworld people around him that we even see in the book that he can turn to them for aid, you know, for alliances when he needs it. And that's a very powerful weapon, you know, in any kind of circumstance, being able to call on allies who maybe are maybe not necessarily stronger than you, but have one, this is the strength in numbers, and two is just have some skills and some abilities and, you know, resources that maybe you don't have at the time.
You know, it's interesting. Did you have to do some research for this book in order to get, you know, information about the gangs?
Not really, no. I kind of worked with what I know and made up some of the rest. There are some books that I've written where I've had to do more research, but this one really just came together so quickly and so easily that I don't really think I had to work at it as much as, you know, as far as doing the research and, you know, answering those kind of questions. I feel like that just really came very quickly and very easily.
Well, all I can tell you is that when I got the book, there were several good points about it. First of all, the font was large so I could read it. It didn't come up in one font like some of the other books I'm getting, which I like, oh, my God, I can't. If a book is in less than 12 or 14 font, I'm going to take a year and a day to read it. Your book took me like 2 hours to read, not even. And it was one of those books like, I want to see what happens next. And I got eye strain, which is a good thing for you because that meant it was a good book.
Oh, well, I'm really glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, trust me. Cheryl knows. There's people like Partners in Crime. Cheryl, Wendy, and Gina are the best. And I have no choice, but they don't ask me if I want the books. They just send them. They just tell me, when you're going to do this one. And even if I don't answer them and say to them, I want the book, they send it anyway. And I think only once out of all the hundreds of books I've done for them did I tell them, I'm not reading this one. I can't take it. And that's rare because there hasn't been one book that hasn't gotten at least 4 or 5 stars, and they're all quality. So you can't go wrong with Partners in Crime, people. Yeah, and
it's true. Yeah,
it should be. Yeah, they are. So Katie is a freelance reporter, but how come she's so street smart? I want to learn some of her street. Well, I'm street smart. That's for sure. Growing up where I did, but she knows how to kick butt, and that's great. So how did she learn how to do this?
You know, I feel like that's kind of a similar answer to what the answer that I gave for Kevin is that the difference being, you know, she grew up outside of Newport City. She grew up in the suburbs. And she had what, by some measure, you'd say maybe a sheltered life. She wasn't exposed to the gangs and things like that. Of course, she had the, you know, her own set of adversity, which, you know, I think I'll leave that to the readers to kind of, you know, discover for themselves as they get to those chapters. But the difference being that when she does move to the city, you know, she's obviously very intelligent. So she would have to, you know, adapt or, you know, die, essentially. And that's where, you know, that intelligence and that wit and that cleverness needs to be applied to becoming more streetwise and, you know, learning everything that there is to know and being aware of everything and picking up cues. And that's what probably would make her such a great reporter, is that attention to detail and that awareness of everything going on. So it's a similar kind of story, I think, that she has to apply. She has to, you know, she doesn't have necessarily the physical tools to be able to, you know, just stand in there with these, you know, muscular gangbangers. Mm. But what she has is she has this intelligence and that wit, and that she's going to use that as her weapon. And so it's a very similar kind of concept, I think. And that's, you know, why I feel like they go so well together as characters in this book.
She's not afraid of them, that's for sure. That's what makes it even better. So King Jamal decides that he's going to have this meeting, and he tells everybody about the money, about the hookers, about stealing, about the chucks, about everything that's been happening. And he looks at Kevin, and why don't these people just, they don't care. How come? He's trying to do something to make peace, and they just don't care.
Well, and again, I'm going to kind of carefully avoid spoilers because I feel like this is one of, you know, this is another one of my really favorite scenes in the book, and it's really is a turning point.
It was mine too.
You know, it really is just, and, you know, I know a lot of people when, you know, people that I talk to that read the book, you know, when they got to that point, it's just like, wait a minute, how did this just happen? And so, you know, I really wouldn't want to spoil that for anybody. But to answer your question, you know, the idea is, it's, you know, kind of like the United Nations. Nobody really wants to work together. Everybody wants to look like they're working together, but nobody really wants to do anything that's not going to benefit them. And I think that's what it boils down to, is everybody sitting in that room is thinking, how does this help me? How does this hurt me? What's my interest in this? And if, you know, they can't come up with a good reason for that, there's no reason to put any effort into it. There's no reason to stick their neck out for it. And that's really what, you know, I think that's what everybody in the room is thinking. And King Jamal is the only one really putting some rational and pragmatic thought into saying, like, this is not a good idea. And this is why we need to work on this. And he knows that nobody's just going to listen to him and take him at his word. But he has, you know, standing next to him, he has Kevin, who, you know, most of the people in that room know, at least by reputation. And if Kevin has something to say, people are at least going to give it an ear. And he's hoping that you know, between all of that and this, you know, information that Kevin has to present, that he can convince them that, you know, everybody's involved, essentially.
How did you come up with, because I don't want to ask any more questions that are related to that part of the book, how did you come up with the chapter headings in the book? Because each chapter sort of like lets you know what to expect or maybe not what to expect, or have an idea. So like, let's see, I have the book in front of me, which is really good, because that does help if I can read one. One says,
well, I think the first chapter,
yeah.
I think the first chapter, business hours, that's you know, that's what's going on right now. This is the hours that, that, you know, the first group and then Kevin, this is the time that they're doing their business. They're out working. And, you know, that was something else that they just came to me. I remember that I came up with the first chapter title first. And I thought it was really clever. I thought it was so good that I had to now, you know, have chapter titles for everything else. Otherwise I wouldn't be able to use it, because it wouldn't make sense to just have one titled chapter and everything else, you know, untitled. So, that kind of made that decision for me. Just having that one good title that I really needed to, make everything else work with. And fortunately, as I went through, you know, a good idea would just kind of pop into my head and be like, oh, this is, you know, kind of what I'm getting across in this chapter. This is the title that I need for it. You know, there's, you know, the deal with the devil and all that other stuff. And I thought it really added a little bit to the reading experience, where you're kind of going through and, you know, the chapter title grabs you and it's like, oh, well, now I need to read it and see what happens in this chapter.
Yeah, well, it sort of sets the tone for the chapter. I mean, there's Knockout, and then there's Rabbit Run, and there's a whole bunch more that you sort of say, well, okay, that's what's going to happen in this chapter. Somebody's going to get knocked
mm-hmm.
out. Or
mm-hmm.
In this one, I don't know, one hope, I can't see that, one more deal with the devil. Now, that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's sort of like lets you know something ominous
mm-hmm.
is going to happen. So,
mm-hmm.
Did you ever have to handle a case of gangs in Hawaii? Did you have to deal with it for real life?
You know, again, we do not have the scourge of it that you have in a lot of the major cities around. But, you know, there's always some of it. So from time to time, yes, you know, the people that I come across in my day job, I guess you could say, may be affiliated with one organization or another.
So do police officers really have informants? I'm reading a whole bunch of them now. I'm going like, oh, this
mm-hmm.
is an informant. You can't kill him off. You can't arrest him. Well,
mm-hmm.
I need to pay him. I mean, there was one book that I just finished where they were skimming drugs off the top in order
mm-hmm.
to pay the informants. I go like,
mm-hmm.
oh, my God. Scary
well,
book. Do they really do that?
What I can tell you, first of all, yes, there is such a thing as confidential informants. It is an absolutely vital part of law enforcement, absolutely. But what you see, you know, in the crime novels and in the movies and things like that is a bit of an exaggeration, because in order
mm-hmm.
to have somebody as a confidential informant, you know, you need to – there's a lot of paperwork that goes in. There's a lot of red tape, because you're essentially sanctioning this criminal because of the information that he's giving you. And so for people like the prosecuting attorneys and everybody else to sign off on it, there's it's not the kind of thing where you can just say, oh, no, it's, you know, it's okay, he's my informant. You really need to have paperwork to back that up. So I think what they say is, you know, a cop is only as good as his snitches. That's another word for informant. A cop is only as good as a snitch. So I think all of us, you know, have to have some snitches out there. We have to have eyes and ears out on the street. But the number that are actually registered and, you know, kind of legitimate confidential informants versus people that are willing to talk to us and pass on information more as, you know, hey, do me a favor sometime down the road versus, you know, oh, no, I'm, you know, you're blessed by the city or the state or the county. I think that's more the former than the latter.
Katie has her own battles to deal with. And
mm-hmm.
you can feel the chemistry between her and Kevin after a while.
Mm-hmm.
But she's got to deal with Kyle's death first too, right? So she's going to be kind of careful about her emotions because she's sort of afraid, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't want to... Yeah, seriously,
you know,
I got upset.
I,
to, like, one thing.
Hmm.
No,
well,
I was thinking that maybe
you know,
they. Go
oh,
on.
Well, please continue. Okay. Well, when I started writing the book, I actually didn't have, I hadn't planned out to have them, you know, kind of have that chemistry, and that's something else that it really developed organically, really naturally. You know, the characters
mm-hmm.
really took on a life of their own as I was writing it. And that just kind of developed as I was writing it, kind of free of my own hand. I was just, you know, not to be cliche, but I guess I was just the medium. But that was, I thought that was really interesting. It actually surprised me, was just how well and how, you know, how well they did have, how well they reacted together and how well their chemistry really became as the book went on. So I found that pretty surprising. But yes, that is absolutely true. You know, she has this big ball of grief hanging over her head like a wrecking ball. And that's, you know, really something that's very important too. And I thought that was also very realistic because again, what inspired it was my own grief, and it was something that, you know, I could feel following me around like that, you know, the cartoon cloud, the black cloud over my head. And it's something
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you have to accept it and you have to deal with it before you can really move on to, to anything else. And that is something that definitely is central to her story.
I agree with you. I know that black cloud never lifts, let me tell you. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
the black, I look up in the sky and I say, okay, could you send the sun down, please, sister? And the
mm-hmm.
sun, when the sun shines, I know she's listening to me. So
mm-hmm.
before
mm-hmm.
I forget,
exactly.
If you think you come from Hawaii, wait till you hear about the author that wrote Vector that's coming on Monday. I'm doing the show at 8 o'clock in the morning because the author is in Japan and it's 14 hours later. So my
sister's
going to be
yeah,
10 o'clock at night, and I'm going to be half asleep at 8 o'clock, but I'm doing it because he asked for the interview. February 16th, and I hope it's going to be confirmed. I am excited. I'm going to interview New York Times bestselling author of Rambo, David Morrell, and John Land, and, good answer, and Andrew Gross are going to be there. We're going to talk about mood and tone in your writing. We're going to talk about voice and narration. On February 21st, New York Times author Stephen Manchester, Ashes. On the 23rd, an author from Scotland is going to be with us at 10 o'clock in the morning, but it's like later there, The Riverman. And on the 28th, if you ever had a dream that you could actually remember and it was very lucid in your head, Lucidity. It should be a very, very interesting show. And before I forget again, you know, kids have to be careful outside, and parents have to make sure to protect them. And a lot of kids get stolen, and that's what's really bad. So yesterday in the Greenberg Public Library, New York Life's Child ID Program, they gave parents that wanted it child ID information sheets, and for that they gave them a free child ID, and I was upset because I wanted one too. But they said I was too grown up to be a child, and I was really disappointed. They said that it doesn't go in any database or anything, but I have the sheet in front of me. There's an awful lot of information that you have to give them. But I think it's a great idea for everyone in the whole world. New York has that. I don't know about Hawaii. They have New York City IDs for everybody that doesn't drive a car and needs an ID, which is great too. And this thing for child IDs is fantastic. So those of you, I spoke to Mike, and he said to let you know that it's still out there. Okay, now, more important, equally as important, Chance. How come he took so many chances with his brother? I mean, it's like a couple of times I go like, Chance, don't take a chance anymore.
Mm-hmm.
How come he was so loyal to Kevin? I mean, I know he's watching out for him, but Chance is kind of strong and he was impetuous too. So why
mm-hmm.
you know, why would he like that? I like that character.
Well, I want to say that I thought that your work of Chance in there was really clever. That was pretty funny. I really did get a chuckle out of that. That was genuine. But to answer your question, I thought that it's that bond of brotherhood between them that, you know, there's really no length that they won't go to for each other. And that was definitely, absolutely an important part of the book when I was writing it and when I was coming up with it, just having that, that connection between the two of them. And, you know, they're both just willing to stick their necks out for the other, for each other. And that's really kind of the test here is where is one of them going to draw that line that, you know, this is as far as I go. If you're going beyond, you know, you're kind of going without me. And, I think that's really the central question for their arc of the story is just where is the limit? Where is the point that, you know, I won't follow you beyond here. And, I think that's really the question that I would hope is on the reader's mind as they're going through these chapters and seeing what happens to the two of them.
Well, you see, I got that. And they have such different personalities, and yet Chance was in prison and he came out and he sort of straightened himself out. And that's what I like about him. And I wouldn't mind if he was watching my back, let me tell you. He's he's great. So Chance, he says, Kevin's futile protest chased Chance into the gloom. Well, Kevin could say whatever he wants, and if Chance wanted to do it, it didn't matter. He was going to do it anyway. And he was going to gamble with the decision just because of his brother. So before we end, question. The ending of the story lets me know that I hope that you're going to bring back Chance, Kevin, and Katie to continue with their story. And at the end, we realize that she's got some issues to take care of. So if you were going to start another story, where would you start it from?
You know, that is a really great question. Believe me, I've been working on this sequel for quite a while because I actually finished the book at the end of 2014, and the question has been on my mind. Where do I go from here? What's the next step? Where would I start a sequel? Where would I even begin a sequel? And the first question is, as you said, I leave it open that any of them can come back, but the more important thing is, will all of them come back? Because it's
I
also
know there's
open
like a
that.
cloudy issue. There's like a cloudy issue there, but I won't say why.
Right. So, you're gonna have to tune in for the next one. That's the best answer that I can give you because to say, oh, Chance will be back, or Kevin will be back, or Katie will be back, or one of them won't be, would really, I think, take something away from the emotional attachment that you have to that character that you can't just, because in life, in the real world, you can't say, oh, this is what'll happen next week. So and so will be there, or so and so won't be. And that is something that I wouldn't want to take away from a reader who's really invested in a particular character. And the reality is that if one of them doesn't come back, that even if that was your favorite character, it will be worth it. I will give you a story that will, eulogize them and really send them off the right way, and at least you'll be able to make your peace with it, I hope. So
Well, at least you'll
to
have the
answer your
closure.
question, right, exactly. So to answer your question, I definitely have left it open for either outcome. And the readers, I hope that everybody listening would, enjoys the book enough to want to pick up that sequel and find out where we go from here.
Well, I've got a whole bunch of people that asked me for the book, and I know that when I go for PT for my hand on Thursday, the girl's going to want it. I mean, they don't even let me go in to see my physical therapist until the hand is out. What did you bring us? I'm
Well,
serious.
Feel free to pass that one on.
It's great because they can't have it because it's autographed, so that's too bad. They're going to have to get their own. Otherwise, if they borrow it,
Well,
they have to give it back. So, two final questions before we ask you where we can find out about everything. How did you come up with the title, which I think was really clever? Because when I got the book, I said, no, I have no idea what this is about. I had a little idea. And how did you come up with that face with those buildings? That was brilliant, let me tell you. So, how did you come up with the title and that cover? Wow.
I'm actually really glad you asked me this, because there's a decent story behind both answers. My fans out there that are listening have, probably read a lot of my blog posts and interviews, and so they know that my oldest friend, he is my muse and my sounding board. And whenever I have something in my head, I'll kind of tell him, and he helps me a lot, and it's not so much with just oh no, this is what you need to do. It's more just listening, and by the time I'm finished saying it, I've kind of answered my own question. And when I don't have the answer, he will not give it to me. He'll poke me and say, well, what do you think about this? And lead me to the answer. And so I have to give him credit for both parts, for both answers, because I was done with the book, and I was sitting there, and I was like, oh, I've got all these great chapter titles. I got this book, but I don't have a title. And one of the things that I think people know me for is my titles. They come up with some pretty clever ones, and most of them come out of the same process of just talking to this friend of mine and, sounding ideas off of him and throwing things out there. And he'll be like, no, that doesn't make sense. That's not good. And so that's where, Concrete Smile came from, was it just kind of clicked in my head, and I said, hey, how does this sound? What do you think about this? And the funny thing was, he at first he didn't like it, but then a few minutes later he said, I do like it, and it gives me this idea for this cover. And so that the original idea for the cover was actually pretty different. It was just going to be the mouse, kind of bloodied up and smiling, and then there would be the buildings in place of the teeth. And when I sent that off to the artist couldn't kind of, I guess get his head around what I was picturing. And so then we were talking about alternatives, and the idea for the face came from, you would, and you're going to appreciate this because you're, growing up in the Bronx, the steeplechase man
Oh,
smiling
yes.
over Coney Island. That was
Yes.
the thing that popped into my head next. And I remember thinking, I think that that's such an iconic thing for, you know, for us kids who grew up in New York, where,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's the symbol of this fun place that we remember in Coney Island, and yet he's so creepy. And that's really, I think, is the reality of life in a big city like that, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, Coney Island, you want it to be the boardwalk, and you want it to be the roller coasters and Nathan's hot dog. And what you really have is Coney Island is,
mm-hmm.
you know, the heart of a lot of, you know, gang activity and drug dealing and prostitution. And so the duality of that was really what I was trying to convey when I brought up the steeplechase man. And that was what I told the artist, was I said, hey, have you ever, you know, do you know this face, the steeplechase face? And, you know, he knew what I was talking about, and we worked it from there. And I'm really so happy with the way that cover turned out, because it really, I think, if, you know, even if you've never seen it before, you've probably caught a glimpse of it. And I really think that as you read the book, that's kind of somewhere in your mind, like that face. And I thought it was a perfect symbol for what I was going for in this book.
Well, this girl used to go to Coney Island on Sunday. If I got my straight A's, my father would take us there because my cousins
mm-hmm.
lived there. And there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like hot dogs, but Nathan's made the best chow mein sandwiches that were great. And they're French fries to die for. And they
mm-hmm.
had like a stand outside in Coney Island. So
mm-hmm.
it really wasn't going into a store. It was great. And I don't like
mm-hmm.
rides. And my sister and my mother would go on all the rides, and the steeplechase and the roller coaster and the cyclone. And I would play Pokemon
mm-hmm.
with my dad. And
right,
I would go
right.
play video games. And then we would go on bumper cars. And I was his partner because I sat in my father weighed 400 pounds. So he would block
mm-hmm.
you know, the bumps, and we could get my sister and my mother. Which
mm-hmm.
was real. It was so cool. So anybody that's never
mm-hmm.
been to Coney Island, you don't know what you meant. Now I won't. I don't know, but then yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, you know, I haven't been there.
I haven't been there
in 20 something years. Yeah.
I haven't been there. It's just that I took when I was teaching, I took my class to the aquarium out there. The kids loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed doing
yeah.
that. It was fun.
So
but
as long as I
issues,
want to point this out though. Real quick, I just before we change the topic, since I had the opportunity to mention Coney Island, I think that those, I'm sure you caught that little reference to the boardwalk and Nathan's and stuff in that
uh-huh.
chapter with Katie and Kyle. And, you know, I'm hoping that a few other people might pick up on that. So just remember, if you've ever been to Coney Island, keep an eye out. You might see a little glimpse of it in this book.
I love Coney Island. You should really write more
mm-hmm.
about it in the next one. My dad grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. He grew up in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
he came by train to the Bronx to meet my mother on Southern Boulevard in Tremont. That's where I grew up. And you didn't want to walk around back then, and you don't want to walk around there back now either.
Mm-hmm.
That's
true, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. If Chase, Katie, or Chance, Katie, or Kevin could tell you, whose voice would you think comes out the strongest in this book? Whose voice do we hear the most, or are they all about the same?
You know, I would say as far as energy goes, I think that they're all the same. They both have very different, they all have very different, you know, volumes, and they have different stories to tell, but, you know, like you said at the beginning, you couldn't really have this story without any one of those characters.
Mm-hmm.
None of them is expendable. None of them you could just cut out. And so I think because of that, that's, you know, you can't answer that and say, oh, no, this person's, you know, voice rings out more true than the other. Because if that were the case, then you could have the same book without that character. And so I think that they're all and that's really what I was going for when I wrote it. I wanted this to be about the three of them, not about so-and-so with, you know, the other two supporting them. It was really a three-person story from start to finish, and that's what I wanted, and I feel like I got that.
Well, can't wait to see what you're going to do next. So tell us where everybody can find out about you. Get 100 copies of the book and about
Absolutely.
Your other work. And listen, people, just because you get scared doesn't mean that you can't buy a couple of dozen books for Valentine's Day, which is Tuesday. And like I said before,
mm-hmm.
buy a whole bunch of books, put them in a basket with flowers and candy, and that would make me happy. I don't need the candy, but the flowers, yeah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, So seriously, where can everybody find out about you and what's next? And for those people from Partners in Crime, you did a fantastic job with this book. I'm
Absolutely.
Going to be posting my review later, which they tell me is probably, I actually read the book, seriously. So you're going to know I read it. And I hope well, it's a 5-star review, so don't even worry about that.
Oh, all right, thank you. I appreciate that.
I haven't given one of those in a while. I sent a review to a publicist, and I said, I'm pushing it to give it 4. I was really pushing it. It was being nice. And the book really was like 3.5 or something. And I just took me forever to read it. If it takes me more than a day to read a book, you're in big trouble, except that the font is small. So where can everybody find out more about you, your work, and send some heat over here, please, from Hawaii?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, of course, you can order all my books on Amazon.com. Just search for Bernard Maestas. You can also check me out on Facebook, Bernard Maestas Official. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram, Bernard Maestas, at Bernard Maestas. You can check me out on the web at www.bernardmaestas.wix.com. That's W-I-X. And, of course, my publisher's website is rebelepublishers.com. And, yep, you can order the books from any of those sites.
Well, that sounds really good. Because when you get the next one, make sure I get it first.
Yeah, I definitely will do, since you gave me that 5-star review. I'll have to give you one.
I've got a good review coming out. Don't worry about that. I'm going to put it out in a couple of minutes as soon as I put, just take a break for a minute from my computer. And I want to thank everybody for listening. And I know that you, Cheryl and everybody are going to, they listen to everything I do, trust me. They will comment and they will let you know about the interview, whatever, but this was a great interview. For those of you that don't know, Bernard's coming back on May 17th with Christina Hoag and Bruce Coffin, and we're going to talk about gangs and gang warfare. And at that point, I will enlist everybody to help contribute to MJ10, which is my magazine. I'll email you a copy of the new one, of MJ9.
Excellent.
So it's for readers, writers. It's a speak-out section. You write up anything you want. It's my magazine. And I'm very excited. So everybody, it's a beautiful day outside. It's freezing, but so what? The sun's shining. And if you really want to go somewhere warm, go to Honolulu, Hawaii, and tell Bernard I sent you. It's beautiful.
Yep, it
thank
is.
You so much for today. Everybody, have
thank
a nice
you for
day.
Having
and
me.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay, bye.